Welcome to Weird Stuff Happens in Canada. My name's Emily.
I'm Britt, and this is Weird Stuff Happens in Canada.
No.
Go with it. This is a podcast about Canada.
Insert theme song. And everyone just make up your own.
It's coming soon, we promise.
Yeah.
It should be something along the lines of like, 'cause she's a lady. Whoa, whoa, whoa,
that's already a song.
Talking about the Canadian ladies.
We don't have the money to, like, use the rights to that song.
All right, fine. Well, in case you couldn't figure it out, we're talking about Canadian women. Badass Canadian women.
Badass Canadian bitches.
Yes, ma'am. And this is going to be part of an ongoing series that will recur.
Because we love ladies.
We do. We love the ladies. And we're starting off at the earliest point in which female history is recorded, which is sadly around the late 1600s, early 1700s in Emily's case for your person. So just a blanket disclaimer before
we begin. I think
we
have a couple disclaimers.
Yes. So as we all know, the recording of history is problematic in that it is consistently written from the perspective of the dominant society, in this case, white men, which is why there's not a lot of recorded history of women's lives earlier than the 1800s, really. And certainly, absolutely not of women of color or the First Nations women of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
If you know of a badass bitch from the 1700s that we don't talk about today, that it could be a white woman or it could be a woman of color, it could be, a person of note of that time period, please let us know. We would love to learn more about...
Tweet it.
Yeah, tweet it at us. Or email us at weirdstuffcanada@gmail.com or follow us and tweet us at weird_Canada on Twitter. And let us know because we'd love to learn more. And we're just going to put a massive caveat on the stuff we're talking about today, is problematic in its own right. And we'll hopefully address some of those problems as we go along with it.
And specifically, this is my addition to the disclaimer. This is the continued disclaimer. It's like, you know, when you read, when you did like academic readings in school and there would be two or three lines of text at the top of the page and then the rest of the page was just the footnote.
Yes.
And it always like made me want to barf a little in my mouth.
Yes.
That's what I feel like this is. It's just a prolonged disclaimer. which is that, you know, obviously it kind of goes with what you're saying about the narrative is written by the victor, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm going to talk about today specifically has a lot to do with the relationship in early Canada with the Aboriginal peoples, and it doesn't always paint them in the best light, and we want to acknowledge that there is obviously so much more to the story that we are not going to cover today, something that we definitely want to discover, something that we definitely want to discover? Is that the word I want? I don't know. Something we want to explore in further episodes.
Yes.
And maybe when we haven't just read one Wikipedia article.
Yes. And to be fair, the article I pulled a lot of my information out, because mine deals a lot with colonizing relations with the Aboriginal people in the west of Canada, and mainly in Manitoba. So I pulled a lot of information from this article written by the Manitoba Historical Society that they made available.
Seems legit.
And it was written in 1901, but they put a caveat at the beginning where they said, you know, a lot of the language in this and the perspective of this article is quite problematic, but we've left it as it was, as like a historical record. So, you know, I took everything in that article with like a massive grain of salt, and I translated it to, you know, the kind of clearest and least offensive way possible. But that being said, you know, a lot of this woman's life is probably, you know, take what I say with a grain of salt also. Disclaimer over.
No, wait.
Okay. Continued disclaimer.
My last part of the disclaimer is that I'm about to say a lot of French words.
Oh, yeah.
Very incorrectly.
That's kind of like a general disclaimer for this podcast is we can't really pronounce things very well. So...
True. Our words are bad.
Yes.
That's why we chose this word forward. See, I'm failing right now in my joke that I was trying to tell about how bad our words are. The whole thing fell apart.
It's about how, like, the medium we chose to do our art in is purely words-based.
Yeah, the medium is the message.
Emily, do you want to talk about a badass bitch from the 1700s?
Do I ever. Is she sort of from the 1600s? Yes. Yay. Do I care? No.
Tell me all about her.
All right. So this is a story of Madeleine de Verchères.
That sounds good.
Thank you. So we go back to 1641.
Okay.
A man named François Jouret is born in France. Maybe. Could have been 1642. Could have been 1640. Right. No one knows for sure.
Bit vague.
Did they believe in time back then? I don't think so. At 24 years old, he came to Quebec with his uncle to fight in what was known as the Beaver Wars.
Yes!
Do you want to know more about the Beaver Wars?
Yes, I want to know everything about it. Did they fight an army of beavers?
No.
Then I don't care about it at all.
So this is a very bad and sort of simplified summary of what was a very complex conflict.
Okay.
Because the Beaver Wars were also called the Iroquois Wars or the French and Iroquois Wars.
Okay.
And it was a fight between the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Oh, nailed it. Practiced that so many times.
That was really good.
Thank you. Also known as the Iroquois or the Five Nations.
Okay.
And other Aboriginal groups and French colonial forces.
Okay.
So I want to say that there's often, I think, in Canadian history, this tendency to see kind of people, Aboriginal groups who were willing to cooperate with colonial forces as quote-unquote friendly Aboriginals.
Right.
I was using air quotes, but I had to say quote-unquote because you can't see me. And then anyone who opposed colonial forces as quote-unquote, like, bad Aboriginal groups.
Like the evil.
Which, of course, is just not... It's not that simple at all.
No.
But basically, in the middle of the 1600s, the... economy of the Haudenosaunee was becoming increasingly dependent on the fur trade. There was an enormous amount of money and also supplies to be made from trading with the Europeans. And so this specific confederacy, which was a kind of a group of different First Nations, they wanted to expand their territory to gain monopoly in the fur trade.
Okay.
So, in the early 1640s, the Mohawk, which was one of the Five Nations, they were attacking French settlements and their Algonquian allies all over the St. Lawrence Valley. The fighting continued on and off. It was basically just years and years of small conflicts, and some people, the Aboriginals would gain ground, and then the colonials would take the ground back, and it was like this whole thing. It continued for over 20 years, basically. They finally signed a treaty in 1667.
Mm-hmm.
So that period is kind of what they refer to as the Beaver Wars. Because it was all being fought over...
Beaver furs.
Rights to fur trade and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But unsurprisingly, it left not a great relationship between the Iroquois, who still lived in the area, and the French settlers.
Right.
So continually going forward, they didn't call it part of the official Beaver Wars anymore, but there were still conflicts for the rest of time.
Right, right.
So this guy Francois,
yes,
he has come to fight in the Beaver Wars. He arrives in 1665, and then 2 years later, they're like, "Oh, these wars are done." And he's like, "Oh, okay, I guess I'll."
Guys, I just got here.
Yeah, he's like, "Well, I guess I'll stay here because, like, I don't want to take another boat ride. That was terrible."
Yeah, like France.
Yeah, who needs it? So he, of course, like any French settler, marries a 12 and a half year old peasant girl.
Ew, Francois! She's too young.
Her name was Marie Perrault, and they married in 1669. And then some lord was like, "Great, here's some land. that it was definitely yours and didn't belong to anyone else. You have it now.
It's yours.
Yeah.
Even though these people don't believe you can buy or trade land.
Yeah.
Just take it.
So Francois and Marie established a small settlement on the south shore of the St. Lawrence.
Okay.
Near Montreal by this, like, basically this point of land that's called Verchere.
Okay.
So they built a small fort to protect their family and their settlers. This was all part of the seigneurial system. So Francois was the seigneur, and then he, like, leased the land to,
okay,
to peasants. So he was kind of like the overlord of, yeah, like, that little area. And most of the seigneurs at the time, they would build a little fort to, like, protect their little bit of land. So there was little forts, like, all along the St. Lawrence. So Francois and Marie had 12 children.
Oh, my God, Marie. Your poor body.
Yeah. So the fourth was Marie Madeleine, or just Madeleine, and she was born in 1678. Because it was a million years ago, not all of the kids survived.
Right.
So she...
that's why you have 12, because you're like, well, hopefully half, yeah, of them survive.
Six out of 12 ain't bad. So Madeleine had an older brother named Antoine who died in 1686. She had an older sister named Mary Jean. We'll call her MJ.
Yeah.
And she actually got married...
to Peter Parker.
Twice.
To Peter Parker.
Neither time to Peter Parker. Ugh. And both of her husbands were killed by the Iroquois.
Ugh.
One in 1687 and one in 1691.
That's gotta be like...
Well, you're...
when the first one happens, you're like, that's really sad. Yeah. And then when the second one happens, you're like, for real?
And she was probably, like, widowed twice by the time she was 20.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're just like, I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just gonna...
I'm an old maid. I'm only gonna live six more years, so this is fine. And then she also had a 16-year-old brother, Francois Michel, who was killed by the Iroquois in 1691. So they didn't have a great relationship with the Iroquois.
Yeah.
So kind of the prelude to this story, which sets up that she was, like, a badass by birth.
Okay.
Is that...
she, like, punched her way out of the womb?
No. It's that Marie, who was Madeline's mom, who was married when she was 12 and a half.
Yep, yep.
She was, like, the lady of the fort, whatever. And in 1690, when she was 33, a group of Iroquois attacked the fort, and her husband wasn't home.
Oh, God.
So she was, like, in charge, Marie, the wife and mother, and she defended the fort with only three or four men.
Oh, my gosh.
Who were there. And she would, the Iroquois, like, tried to, there was, like, a big fence around it. It was, like, 12 to 15 feet high, and they would try to climb it to get inside, and she would just shoot them in the face with muskets.
Oh, my God.
Because she was like, nobody's climbing this wall. It was a siege that lasted for 2 days before the Iroquois were like, this woman is, like, too hardcore. Let's go.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So that was, like, the kind of woman who was raising Madeline.
Yeah. Honestly, that woman's a real badass.
Real badass.
Yeah.
You got all the badass points. So, the main event.
Right.
October 22nd, 1692.
Okay.
Madeline is 14 years old.
Okay.
And her parents and the soldiers who lived in the fort were like, we're going to go because we got to go get supplies for the winter because otherwise everyone will die. You're in charge. Good luck.
The 14-year-old girl is in charge?
So they leave her in charge of the fort, and she's like, great, I got this. This is amazing.
She, like, put her music on real loud, and she was like, home alone.
Yeah.
Finally home alone.
It was her and one really old soldier.
Yes. Oh, my God. Why is there not a movie about this?
Right? So, in... one morning, a group of settlers left the fort to go work in the fields because they were still harvesting things.
Right.
And she was working in the cabbage garden that was close to the gate. Everything I read specifically mentioned the cabbage. Very important part of the story. So, there's a surprise Iroquois attack.
Oh, my gosh.
And
at this point, it should not be a surprise anymore,
I know.
Guys.
Like, you guys, they're like, oh, my God, we never saw it coming.
Like, literally, most of your family was killed by these attacks.
Yeah, and they attack you, like, it seems like every 6 months. So you should not be surprised. You probably shouldn't have left your 14-year-old daughter in charge of the fort. But the reason they took all the soldiers with them is because otherwise the Iroquois would attack their and take their supplies on the way back. So they didn't really have a choice. So there were a bunch of men working in the fields, and they tried to get back to the fort, but the Iroquois, like, the point of the attack was that they were going to capture them.
Okay.
And then either, like, enslave them or ransom them back. Like, it's not really clear.
Yeah.
So all of these men, and the, one of the things about this story is that accounts vary widely about right. what happened, because nothing was written down until, like, 6 or 7 years after it happened.
Okay.
And there was an account written by Madeline that seems pretty accurate, and that's the one that kind of people kind of go off of as being what happened. But then she wrote another one, like, 20 years later that was like, and they all had guns, and they all fired them at me, and I dodged all the bullets. Like, it gets out of control.
She's like, I cartwheeled off the parapet yeah. and kicked them all in the face.
Yeah. So this is, like, maybe close to what happened.
Okay.
So because she was, as I said, in the cabbage garden.
Right.
She was much closer to the gates of the fort. And so when she saw the Iroquois, she started running.
Right.
But because a full-grown warrior was chasing her, yeah. he caught up to her.
Probably, like, on a horse, too.
I think he was on foot. So okay. he was running, and she was running, and he caught up to her, and he grabbed her, like, kerchief that she was wearing around her neck, but she untied it.
Oh, my gosh.
And got into the fort and slammed the gate.
Okay.
So she's now inside the fort. But inside the fort, there's, like, women and children.
Yeah.
One old soldier.
Love that old soldier.
And Madeline.
Yeah.
So... oh, yeah. She runs inside and she's shouting, two arms, two arms.
And the old soldier's like, ugh, yeah. just give me a minute.
So she grabs a musket and she, like, fires it into the air, basically, to yeah. be like, we're here. And she told all the people inside, again, women and children, to start making as much noise as possible.
Right.
So that they it think- seems like the fort is full of soldiers. Which, like, I feel like the flaw in this plan is that if the Iroquois are attacking, they obviously know that all the soldiers have left.
Yeah.
Anyway, that doesn't seem to cross her mind.
Also, it's just, like, a bunch of little kids going, oh, yeah, yeah, it's...
I'm a soldier!
I'm dangerous! I got a gun!
Yeah. Yeah. I assume they all, like, two kids would go inside a coat and, like, yeah. be like, I'm a soldier now! So the one old soldier, he fires the fort's only cannon.
Oh, wow.
Because that's how they would, like, warn other forts
right.
that there was an attack, and then other forts would, like, send people, like, send reinforcements. So Madeline and the settlers, they were like, great, this is great, we'll just convince them that the fort is full of soldiers. So they just, like, kept, they put on helmets and they kept, like, patrolling the walls, and oh they would God. Just periodically call out all's well to each other, even though, like, they did not need to do that because they could all see each other to keep up this charade.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the Iroquois stayed for somewhere between 2 to 8 days. It's very unclear.
Uh-huh.
And eventually they just were like, I guess this fort is full of soldiers. We didn't realize we're here. I think they were like, this fucking girl.
Yeah.
But, like, we're not going to get inside, so let's just go. So they finally gave up, and then reinforcements that had been sent from Montreal, like, met them as they were leaving.
Oh.
And a battle ensued, and they, like, got back the settlers that they had captured.
Oh.
And then after the reinforcements came and, like, everything was okay, then Madeline's parents came back.
So what you're saying is, like... Madeline, like, this is the OG Home Alone.
Yes.
Like...
OG Home Alone.
Was actually a 14-year-old girl...
Yeah, she, like...
Defending a fort.
She, like, put a burning iron and would, like, swing it down. She, like, put, like, toy soldiers on the floor yeah. so that they would step on them. Like, all the Home Alone tricks from this story. So after this happened, life just basically went back to normal. Madeline's father, Francois, died in 1700, and he had a pension because he was, like, a part-time soldier of 150 livres, and the pension was actually transferred to Madeline
okay.
in recognition of, like, what had happened.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Although it was transferred to her on the condition that she provide for her mother, which to me states that, like, the relationship with her mother was not great. Because they were like, but you can't just leave her here to die. And she was like, ugh, darn. So she actually, in a very uncommon decision. Madeline put off her marriage because she wanted to take care of the fort and like run the seigneury. And she didn't get married until she was the ripe old age of 28.
Whoa.
In 1706.
She was like an old spinster.
She was an old spinster. She got married to a lieutenant of the colonial troops. And they got their own little piece of land on the north shore of the St. Lawrence. And she lived there until she was 69.
Oh my gosh.
And she ruled over the small group of settlers with sort of a tyrannical iron fist. But we don't need to talk about that because it's simpler just to see her as a badass bitch.
A badass 14-year-old. Yay! Good job, Madeline.
Yeah, she was like really mean to people all the time and like was maybe a bit crazy, but that's neither here nor there.
Amazing. Okay, well, my story also deals with relations with the First Nations community. Great. And people with a lot of French names that I can't pronounce.
Both things that are right in our wheelhouse.
So my story is about Marie-Anne Gabory.
Just at least say it like you pretend you know how to say it.
Gabory. That's not going to be her name for long, so let's not worry about it. She was born November 6, 1782. Possibly 1785. Possibly 1780. Nobody knows. And she was born in Muskingee in Trois-Rivières. She had a really early, a nice, quiet life. She had no idea what her life was going to lead her to.
Wow. What foreshadowing.
So in the winter of 1806, when she was age 24-ish, who knows?
Anywhere between 10 and 30.
A young man named Jean-Baptiste Lagimonière. I can't say it.
It's fine. Just go with it.
We'll call him Jean-Baptiste. He came to visit his family in Marie's town after spending 5 years in the Northwest as a voyageur, which we remember from the Beaver Club episode.
The Beaver Club.
So everyone was like, whoa, who is this handsome young man with all these tales of adventure? And they were like, Marie, you got to meet this guy. And she was like, I'm not really interested. And they're like, Marie, for serious, go meet this guy.
He's got a ponytail. Yeah. He's got short pants.
He's like young and well-traveled.
He probably has most of his teeth.
Yeah. And she's like, all right, fine. So she goes to this party. She meets him and she's like, whoa, this guy is handsome. Let's get married.
So many teeth.
So everyone thought that like after he had spent 5 years out in the West, he was probably done. He was going to come back, be a farmer. And he like told Marie, he's like, I'm done with that life. I'm out. And she's like, great. And then he's like, do you want to get married? And she was like, great, great, great. Yes, I do. And then at 1 month after they got married in 1807, he was like, actually, when I said that I was never going to travel again, what I really meant was I'm immediately going to go traveling again. Bye. She was like, damn it. And so she tried to convince him not to go, but he was like, I'm going. And so she had two choices. She could either stay where she was and not see him again for years, or potentially never again, because the risk of death is very high, or she could go with him. And so she's like, I'm going with you. So they pack up all their shit. And this begins the epic journey of Marie into the West.
And isn't there a song called Into the West?
I don't know.
It's the song. It's like really gonna betray a lot about me. It's the song. Isn't that the name of the song that Annie Lennox sings at the end of Lord of the Rings?
Oh, yes.
What can you see? Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it's called.
Except she doesn't, like, sail to the Grey Lands and, like, die, quote-unquote, or, like,
become live forever immortal, or whatever they do.
So they pack up in, like, a big canoe. There's, like, two big canoes, and all the voyagers are going out. And so Jean-Baptiste is like, bring my wife. And so they're like, great. So they, like, tuck her in the bottom of the canoe with, like, all the stuff. And they're like, it wasn't, like, she didn't have to do any of the paddling or anything, but it was still really hard because she wasn't allowed to move at all. And it was like, she was just like under the sun all day. You have to like lie there perfectly still and just like in the sun. So it's exhausting. And this is a woman who's never done any traveling or anything like that her whole life. And they sleep on the ground. There's no tents. There's no other women traveling. So she's just like pretty much by herself. When they get to the entrance of Lake Superior, just north of Sault Ste. Marie, it's like a notoriously like incredibly dangerous part because it's like where the waters are meeting.
Ah, the rapids.
Yeah. And so there's like a massive storm and one of the canoes is like completely destroyed and like lost. No. And Marie like tells that story to her children later on as like this moment of like pure terror that like, you know, she like saw God essentially. So then they stop at Lake Winnipeg for the winter, and a lot of traders, Jean-Baptiste was known as a free man, which means that he did trapping and trading, but he wasn't affiliated with the Hudson's Bay Company or the Northwest Company. He's kind of like a freelancer.
Yeah.
So him and a lot of other freemen traders lived in this area around Lake Winnipeg, and a lot of the guys there would take Aboriginal women for wives. Mm-hmm. And when they get there, Marie realizes that for the 4 of the 5 years Jean-Baptiste had been living out there, he had like an Aboriginal woman as a partner. So she's like, and then the Aboriginal woman was like, who the fuck is this woman?
Yeah.
And then he's like, I don't know. This is my wife. And then
that's Marie's my wife
like,
too. I don't know. Bye.
And Marie's like, hi, ha, ha, ha. And so she becomes friends with the other women, and they don't speak the same language, obviously, but they communicate through signs, and this is, like, where she starts learning how to, like, communicate through signs with the First Nations people. Mm-hmm. But this woman, like, and this is, like, take this with a massive grain of salt, but this article said that Jean-Baptiste, our original wife or partner, like, hated Marie and, like, had concocted a plan to poison her.
I mean, maybe.
Like, maybe. And then one of the other Aboriginal women, like, caught on to the fact, and she, like, warned Marie through signs. And then Marie was like, ah, shit. And she, like, told Jean-Baptiste, and Jean-Baptiste was like, we're out. And so they, like, packed up all their stuff and left.
I just want to say that right now, if this was not just audio, I would be doing, like, a lot of hilarious poison miming comedy, but because of the medium that we've chosen, that opportunity has been taken away from me, and I'm pretty upset about it. Continue.
So because they're not where around Lake Winnipeg in that kind of contained area, they're just like out in the wild. Mm-hmm. And while they're out there, for months, Marie's first child is born. So she's been pregnant this whole time also.
Like, I'm so sorry for all of the women who came before us, 'cause like your lives are such shit. And everyone was so mean to you, and then you just like had a baby while you were walking through the woods, and like props.
I know.
Mad props.
And like, was she pregnant when they were in that massive storm on Lake Superior?
Like, maybe.
Probably. So like cheers to you.
Yeah.
And she was like a really sad and lonely time in her life because she was pretty staunchly Catholic, and so she like couldn't baptize her baby, and she was like removed from like the church and her community, and and the baby was born on the king's birthday, so they called her Rien, I guess, which is king. Rien? Well, you know.
Queen, but yeah.
Whatever. So in the spring, Jean-Baptiste is like, I'm going to Saskatchewan. I'm going with these guys. They're my friends. And she's like, all right, fine. So she like goes with these guys, and they all have their wives also. So they get in canoes, they head out. It's 1809. This is when she begins to adopt some smart indigenous customs. One of which that I really like was that she puts her baby in like a bag made of moss. So she just has this like moss bag, and like her little baby's just like,
ooh, I love moss.
I'm a moss baby.
That's so cute.
I know.
It's like everything. What is that woman who like takes the pictures of the baby?
Yeah, Ann Geddes. It was like, oh, gee, Ann Geddes. That's amazing. So they arrive at a place called Cumberland House. And while they're there, again, like with a grain of salt, there's a large community of indigenous people there, and they've never seen a white woman before because Marie was the first white woman to venture this far west.
Wow.
So they're really like fascinated by her and interested, and they show her a lot of like respect, and they're just kind of like interested in like her skin and like what she looks like, and with the baby also. And so they continue into the prairies. And while they're out in the prairies, there's this one night where they're all sitting around the campfire, and one of the guys they're traveling with, he starts screaming, and they can hear him screaming, and they all like run over, and he's being dragged into the woods by a grizzly bear.
What?
And then
so she throws her moss baby at it.
No. So she's like, calls for Jean-Baptiste, and Jean-Baptiste like runs over and is like, holy shit, like goes back, grabs his gun, brings the gun over, and he's like trying to shoot the bear, but the risk is that when the bear is that close to a person, you might shoot the person.
Yeah.
But the guy is like, he's like, quote, shoot, I would rather be shot than eaten alive. Oh, so God. He shoots the bear, and the bear like lets go of the guy whose name was Bouvier. And then the bear charges at Jean-Baptiste, and then Jean-Baptiste is like, ah, fuck, and he, like, jumps into his canoe, and there's another gun in there loaded, because, like, the gun he already has fired is, you have to, like, reload the gun, and
oh,
it's, like,
yeah.
a process.
We remember.
Yeah. And so with that second shot, he kills the bear, and this poor guy, his whole face was, like, ripped off.
Oh, my God.
But he was still alive, and so Marie, like, through her ingenuity, like, kind of puts his face back together, and then she like takes care of him and like gets him through, and like the guy survives, and
Whoa.
Then he like
did they call him Bearface after that?
I don't know if I hope so or I hope not. He just like he was blind and like spent the rest of his days just like carving crosses, they said, at a monastery.
Oh my God.
But he lived thanks to Marie, so that was a cool thing she did. Then they arrive at Fort of the Prairies, which is now known as Edmonton.
Oh.
They spend 4 years. Jean-Baptiste is gone a lot, like, off hunting and trading. And when the first season is over, they leave the fort to go hunt buffalo.
Sure.
While they're out hunting buffalo, they were saying in this article that horses have this weird thing about buffalo where when they see them, they just, like, freak out and they run right into them.
Because they're like, ah, a fat horse!
Yeah, I think so. And so Marie's, like, on this horse, and they said she's a very accomplished rider, but, so she's, like, on this horse, she has, like, Moss Baby hanging off one end, and then, like...
How has Moss Baby not turned into Moss Child by this point?
Still a little baby. It's only been a couple months. Like, all this is happening. Like
I thought this
months.
Was like 7 years later.
No, still Moss Baby. And then it's like counterweighted with like a bag of food. And so her horse bolts. And so she goes right into this herd of buffalo. And she's like trying to maintain her seat and also trying to like keep Moss Baby on the horse so that they don't like fall off and get trampled by buffalo. Because buffalo start like freaking out when like a horse runs into them. And so she survives this by like reining in her horse. And Jean-Baptiste kind of like comes over and like helps her. But then because of this, like the stress of this, she like immediately goes into labor and has her second child.
So I'm sorry, she's on the horse like 9 months pregnant.
Yep. She has baby number two.
Oh my God.
And because baby number two was born on the prairies, they named him Jean-Baptiste like Junior, but then she always nicked him La Prairie because he was born on the prairies.
So she was like, these are my kids, Queen and Prairie.
Yeah. Yep, she was the original Kim and Kanye. So as a bit of an off story, I don't know if this is true either, because this kind of rings similar to, like, what my Italian relatives say about, like, the Roma people, about how they, like to kidnap babies. But apparently Jean-Baptiste Jr. was, like, such a beautiful little baby that the indigenous people kept trying to steal him. I don't know if that's true or not. Probably not. But there is this one great story where this, like, this chief of a tribe, he, like, thought he was, like, such a beautiful little boy. And so he goes to, like, Marie and he's like, I will give you a horse for this baby. And Marie's like, no. And
you can't then, have Prairie. He's mine.
And then he's like, okay, two horses. And she's like, no. And then he's like, two horses and also this child. And she's like, no.
He was like, I'll trade you this child that no one wants for the child that is yours.
Yeah. And then she just, like, broke down and, like, was hugging the child and crying. And the guy was like, whoa, okay. Like, calm down, lady. Like, fine.
Women are hysterical.
Keep your beautiful baby. And it's really funny because later on in the article, she has, like, another son later on, and they're like, he wasn't as beautiful as Jean-Baptiste, so there was no difficult, no one tried to kidnap him. So she becomes more and more hardened as the time goes on, obviously,
yeah.
and more and more familiar with the indigenous people living out there. There's this story from 1809 where Jean-Baptiste went out to, so their horses went missing, and so he went out to go find them. He was gone for the day, and there's this, excuse my pronunciation, but it's Sarsi tribe? Sarchi? I don't know. Sorry.
You're looking at me like I'm going to have the answers, and I do not.
So the tribe comes across their camp, and they're on the war path, because they have a kind of a battle of revenge against the Cree.
Mm-hmm.
And the traders that Jean-Baptiste and Marie were with, all their wives were Cree, and so they are, like, expecting to find, like, Cree women, and they're like, oh, this will be a good chance for us to, like, get our retribution.
Right.
But those men had already fled to the fort, and, like, Jean-Baptiste and Marie were just like, we're just two white people.
Just white people.
And so they come onto the tent, and it's just, like, Marie with, like, her two babies in bags of moss. And and so they... she, like, uses signs to communicate with them, and she's like, oh, my husband, he's just, like, out finding these horses, and they're like, cool, 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 and then she's like, do you guys want some meat? And they're like, yeah, okay, and so they, like, all sit down, she, like, makes them some meat, they're like, delicious, this lady's great, and it's, like, a great time. but after this kind of run-in, it's, like, she's, like, anxious, and she doesn't want to go back out on the prairie, and so they spend, like, a winter at the fort, but then in 1810, Jean-Baptiste is like, back to the prairie, and she's like, ugh, and then they have their third baby. And they have their third baby, like, in the mountains.
I can't. Did they call it mountain?
She calls it Cypress, because...
I'm so mad.
But her real name was Josette.
It's a girl?
Yeah. Yeah. Queen, prairie, Cypress.
Tree. Here's my third baby, tree.
So in 1811, Lord Selkirk, who we remember from the Beaver Club, he's an OG member of the Beaver Club. He was a Scottish nobleman who established the first colonies in Western Canada.
I remember everything about that.
So this is, like, his first colony. He's like, I got a great idea. I'm going to build a colony along Lake Winnipeg in the Red River area. So it's like Jean-Baptiste and Marie are like, great. We'll go there. We'll be a part of this, like, colony. The colonists have a real, like, hard time coming over, and they get, like, really sick, and they die, and it's, like, a really hard passage. So, like, for the first year, like, Marie and Jean-Baptiste are just, like, there by themselves with, like, their kids.
This is our colony.
Yeah. And within that first year, they have another baby, Benjamin, the ugly one. I don't know if he was ugly, but he just wasn't as beautiful as the other Jean-Baptiste.
So she gave him a, like, regular person name?
Because they were there, and because there was no, like, it said in the article, it's like, because he wasn't born in, like, the midst of adventures, his name was Benjamin.
She was inspired by, like, the tree that she leaned against to give birth.
Yeah, just Benjamin. Little Benny.
Wow.
We'll call him Eggs.
We're not going to call him Eggs.
Eggs Benny. So from 1812 to 1815, she's alone with these four kids in this tiny hut in Red River while, like, her husband is, like, out and about hunting and stuff like that. And then in 1815, Jean-Baptiste is like, I gotta go for, like, an even longer period of time.
Oh my god, this guy!
So, at this time, Hudson's Bay Company versus Northwest Trading Company, they're having, like, a lot of fights and battles, going back and forth. They're, like, attacking each other's forts, and it's a little bit like today's current fight between, like, Tim Hortons and Starbucks, where, like, one... One person would build a fort and start trading, and then the other company would immediately build a fort, like, right next to it, and be like, now we're getting all the pelts. And,
classic.
Right? And so...
everyone come get your double-double.
And at the same time, Lord Selkirk had bought a ton of shares in the Hudson's Bay Company. Like, it was worth, they were saying, like, let's say, like, 100,000 shares, and he bought 40,000. So he almost bought half the company
out.
That's
so much.
So he was like, I'm going to establish this colony in Red River to help support the Hudson's Bay Company and, like, act as kind of a resistance to the Northwest Trading Company. And the rivalry is, like, erupting, and at the time it was really hard to get letters from Red River to Montreal, and Selkirk at the time was in Montreal.
Because you just like tied it to a horse and were like, go!
Be free! And so Jean-Baptiste wasn't really connected with anyone, but if he was to choose an alliance, he would lean towards Hudson's Bay Company. So the men of the Hudson's Bay Company, they were like, you're really good at what you do. Can you please get these letters to Selkirk in Montreal? So he was like, peace out, Marie. Going to Montreal.
Oh.
On his way, he gets the letters to Selkirk, and then on his way back, he gets captured by the Northwest Trading Company and imprisoned for like a couple months. And he's there until some of the Hudson's Bay Company comes through and like liberates the fort, and then he's free. But meanwhile, Marie is like back at Fort Douglas, like with her kids. There's like a lot of stuff going on. Northwest Trading Company attacks the fort with like a band of Métis. Mm-hmm. And luckily this like Métis tradesman, he like knew Marie. And so he like went to her like the day before and he was like, heads up, they're attacking the fort tomorrow. You got to get out.
Whoa.
And so she takes her like babies and they like get in a canoe and they go stay with a bunch of Aboriginal people who like live across the river. And like, luckily, no one was, like, killed when they took over the fort, but she at least wasn't imprisoned with her children.
Yeah.
And then there's, like, an abandoned shack that this, like, trader owns that he's, like, gone for the winter. So she moves her family into this shack. They're there. She's alone. It's, like, 3 months since Jean-Baptiste has been gone. She's like, where the fuck is my husband? I'm alone. Do I have to raise these kids on my own now? What is happening? It's, like, a really hard time. And then Jean-Baptiste, like, pops up. And he's like, it's me. I'm back. I was in jail. And she's like, oh, God, thank God you're back. And they're, like, really happy. So from that moment on, they kind of settle in Red River.
In the shack.
In the shack. They, like, start, like, planting and building. The other colonists come, and it's very, very difficult. And I think the thing that not a lot of people think about is, like, in these early colonies, how, like, literally you were living, like, day-to-day, hand-to-mouth. Mm-hmm. Like, if there was no, like, food to hunt, like, you would die.
Yeah.
And, like, somehow they managed to have 3 more children. So they had 7 children altogether, and all children survived until adulthood.
Those lost bags.
I know, man. And so they had Joseph, Julie. Oh no, I wrote Joseph twice. What was the other son's name?
Eggs.
Oh well. Eggs. There were 7 of them. And that was like 1818, 1820, 1825. They had more kids. Finally, she's done. Some priests show up. It's great. She's like finally has religion back. She's very self-sacrificing. She like gives up her food to like feed the priests when the priests like don't have anything to eat.
Oh my God.
She really wants to go back. Once all her kids are kind of like left the nest, she really wants to go back to what they call Canada, which was like the eastern part of the country, to be with her family. But Jean-Baptiste is like, no, we're staying in Red River and we're never leaving. And so they stay there until 1850 when Jean-Baptiste dies. And then she goes to live with her son, Benjamin. And then in 1880, she dies at the ripe old age of 95.
Oh, my God.
I know. So.
Everyone must have been like, she's a witch.
Yeah, she's a witch. So she lived long enough to meet many of her grandchildren, and see them live on and further her legacy. Her second youngest daughter, Julie, had a son named Louis. He was born in 1844 and became known as the founder of the province of Manitoba, who you might know as Louis Riel.
Oh my God!
And he led 2 rebellions against the newly founded government of Canada, fought to preserve Métis rights and culture. He's considered a folk hero by Francophones, Catholic nationals, and the Native rights movement. And he's her grandson.
That's so amazing. It's like a woman who, you know, it's not one specific thing that she did. Mm-hmm. She just, in the face of all odds, survived and kept her family alive.
Yeah, and that was the thing. You know, I was going through her story and I was like, I don't know if there's enough here. Like, she didn't do anything. She didn't invent anything. Mm-hmm. But, like, she lived and survived and, like, for the most part, did it herself in, like, an inhospitable land where she was, like, left by her husband for, like, months at a time.
He really seems like the worst.
Yeah.
So.
And he really changed the course of her life because, like, he was like, I'm not traveling. Marry me. then they got married and he was like, now let's go. And yeah. she never saw her family ever again.
That's really sad.
Yeah. So I know. But she like built this legacy and like Louis Riel, we should probably talk about it at some point because like he's a very famous figure. We and
for
like,
sure talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so she's known as like the grandmother of Manitoba or the grandmother of the West because she was like that first woman to like get out there.
Mad props to you, Marie.
I know, Marie. And her Moss Bag Babies.
That's our band name.
Yes.
Moss Bag Babies. So that was volume one of Badass Bitches. There will be many more volumes to come.
Yeah.
And
we'll see you next week.
We won't see you because this is audio only. The medium is the message. Bye.
Bye.